We're back with Backstory with the American History Guys. I'm Peter Onuf, otherwise known as 18th Century Guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, Backstory's 19th Century Guy.
And I'm Brian Ballow, representing the 20th Century. Today on the show, we're marking the 150th anniversary of the Civil War's beginnings by asking what motivated people on both sides of the conflict to take up arms. Before the break, we were looking at the Union cause. Now we're going to shift to the Confederacy.
You know, the old saw is that the Civil War was a rich man's war and a poor man's fight, and that actually turns out not to be accurate.
This is Aaron Sheehan-Dean, an historian at the University of North Florida. A few years ago, he published a book called Why Confederates Fight, a book that also answered the question of who those Confederates were.
Wealthy men and wealthy counties send much higher proportions of men than do poorer places. And the army is also different in ways that we might not imagine. We would assume that this army would be composed of younger men, of unmarried men. In fact, a majority of the soldiers in the Confederate Army are married. They have families. So they're deeply invested in protecting their families and preserving the society as they know it in 1860 and 1861.
So what about all the men who did not own any slaves? Why would they have flocked to enlist and continue to enlist even after the initial excitement of war had worn off? This is the real million-dollar question for Sheehan-Dean. After all, slaveholders may have been overrepresented in the Confederate Army, but they still made up a minority of the ranks.
After spending a lot of time with letters that Virginia soldiers sent home to their families, Sheehan-Dean concluded that there were three main reasons why non-slaveholders felt that they, too, had something worth fighting for. The first was political. Recent democratic reforms had given white men new voting rights that they worried could be undone by the Lincoln administration. The second was economic. They realized that the strength of the Southern economy depended on slavery, and in classic American fashion, many of them aspired to join the ranks of slaveholders one day. It was aspirational. But the third, well, that one's a lot trickier. So I asked Sheehan-Dean to explain himself. So I'm familiar with people fighting for political rights and their economic stake in society. But here's one that really threw me for a loop, Aaron. Maybe you can help me out. Companionate marriage? I didn't even know what that term meant.
Yeah, now we just call it love. Right? It's a,
I don't know what that means either, Aaron.
It's the job of historians to muddy the waters. The notion of a companionate marriage, of a marriage built on love, though, is actually a pretty recent thing in the middle of the 19th century. We tend to assume that emotions are the same and that families are the same because they're such bedrock parts of our lives. But in fact, the notion of how families are constituted and how people within them relate to one another was changing in the 18th and 19th centuries. And we were moving from a period in which the model of the family was as a microcosm of the state, in which the father was the king and you obeyed him because it was God's law, to a model in which husbands and wives came together because they loved one another and they respected one another. And even more importantly, that parenting absorbed this same ethos, that parents should love and respect their children, and children should respect their parents because they love them. And this creates, I think, a much stronger and more intimate kind of bond within these families. And so as the war grinds on, and particularly in parts of the Upper South, like Virginia and Tennessee, as the North wages a hard war which imperils their loved ones and puts greater hardships on women and children at home, soldiers talk about the necessity of protecting their families because of their love for those families. Mm-hmm. And I think we've tended to talk about the motivation of soldiers in terms of hate and in terms of hating the Yankee. But in fact, what I saw in these letters over and over again was that many more men spoke about love and the love of their families as the primary reason that they were fighting.
One of the things you stress in your book is how the motivations for fighting change as the war drags on. Could you tell me how Lincoln's proclamation freeing the slaves changed things?
Yeah, well, it fundamentally changes things because up to that point, the Union Army had been quite inconsistent in terms of its policies on slavery. And in some places, under some commanders, it returned slaves. And in other places, it emancipated them. And the Emancipation Proclamation then makes quite clear that if the Confederates lose, whatever society they return to will be completely different than the society that they left. So it means now that particularly non-slaveholding men, are going to be competing with enslaved men who are now freed. They will be competing with them at all levels. And the fear and paranoia about what that represented is almost impossible for us to capture today. But it, I think, certainly inspired most of them to fight much harder, because now there was no going back. There was no finding a peace that would allow them to have the Virginia they used to know if they failed.
And did those fears extend beyond the political economy? In other words, were these soldiers worried about this post-apocalyptic society with slavery ending in which there was actually social mixing among the races?
They are. I mean, certainly the rhetoric of what would happen socially in the event of emancipation that had been used extensively by Southerners and Democrats in the years before the war then bloomed during the war. And non-slaveholders as well as slaveholders imagine that black men, once emancipated, are going to be out to capture their wives and their daughters. And there's a long, long rhetoric of really vile kind of racialized, sexualized imagery about what black men are going to be doing to white women. And that threat is a much more immediate social threat to a home front that's largely undefended in most parts of the Upper South because the rates of enlistment were simply so high. 70-80% of white men, eligible white men, would have been in the armies and serving away from their home communities. So that's really the immediate threat, is what's going to happen in the wake of emancipation. And, you know, decades of hysteria and sort of fear mongering about that possibility then produce a great deal of anxiety among those soldiers who are now not at home.
Let me ask you about all of these causes. You know, when we ask why did the Confederate soldier fight, you've now laid out a number of them. I'm just curious, on the ground level, how did individuals integrate, balance, deal with these competing motivations, ranging from it's my obligation to protect my wife, who, by the way, wasn't imposed on me, but I chose and I love, to states' rights?
Yeah, well, they struggle with them all the time, and particularly when they come into tension, when the collapse of slavery creates insecurity and fear that might compel them to go home. And there's a great letter from a soldier named John Jones, whose wife has written to him. His wife's name is Molly, saying, "You need to come home. You know, we need protection here." And he says to her, "I'm going to stay in the army." He says, "This is the best place to protect you. And it's important that we strike now." He says, "We need to get the Yankees now while they're organizing. I'm afraid they might come home and get my boy." Right. That is, what had been in the pre-war period would have been envisioned as a kind of personal effort to repel, honor, you'd use violence to protect your family,
right,
becomes a corporate form during the war, and a recognition that the army is the best way to do this. But there's this tension, and they, you know, are basically arguing with and trying to convince their wives in many cases that this is in fact the best decision, because a lot of the wives weren't at all convinced.
Yeah. Now, you know, I'm a 20th century guy. I think of the literature that comes out of World War II and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, all this complaining about the boredom and bureaucracy. Do you come across a lot of that too? I mean, you know, in all of this emphasis on why they fought, do we sometimes kind of lose track of the fact that often they weren't so keen on fighting?
No, they're not keen at all. I mean, that's in fact all the letters are long complaints. And I have to imagine, you know, soldiers often complain to their wives, "Your last letter was 3 days late. Why haven't you written?" And I think if I received your letters twice a week and it's just, you know, 3 pages of complaints, I probably wouldn't be eager to respond either after 6 months of that. Soldiers had a great deal to complain about. I don't begrudge them their complaints. You know, the food is both bad and scarce. You know, dysentery and diarrhea are rampant. Every man would have been infested with lice and had scabies and all sorts of sort of kind of routine physical problems that you 20th century guys don't have to worry about. You know, we've got clothes and shoes and socks, and, you know, a lot of these men march barefoot into, and you know, up to Antietam in the fall of 1862.
No, it's incredible.
And a lot of them felt like the army was poorly run and poorly managed and poorly supplied, and they complained bitterly and always. And it's not an expression of disloyalty. It's an expression of frustration and anger over the fact that they aren't being provisioned the way they need to be provisioned if they're going to be able to do their jobs. And they've signed a contract to fight for the Confederacy. The least the Confederacy can do is get them some, you know, rancid corn and mealy meat or something.
Yeah. And you mentioned loyalty, which is so important. If I read your book correctly, that loyalty actually grows and deepens over the course of the war, in spite of, you know, what we might call the complaining or that classic Civil War term, kvetching.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right that it deepens, which is surprising. We would anticipate, and the traditional story gives us a story of sort of, you know, kind of waning morale. The morale deepens as the crisis of what failure, of what defeat looks like, looms larger for these men. They certainly wear down and they wear out in many cases. And I think ultimately that's what accounts for Confederate defeat, is simply wearing out. But in the process, these men have committed themselves very, very deeply to a Southern nation, to the Confederacy, but a Southern nation that lives on beyond the Confederacy. It's the Confederate state that is destroyed by the Civil War. But I think, unfortunately, not a very deep sense of sectional loyalty that presents enormous problems for post-war America, for reconciling these men. This is one of the classic problems of Civil War, and one that Lincoln recognized, that the harder you fight and the more bitter and the longer the fight goes on, the more difficult that post-war reconciliation is going to be.
Aaron Sheehan Dean is an historian at the University of North Florida and author of the book Why Confederates Fought. Thank you so much for joining us, Aaron.
Thanks, Brian. That was great.
So Aaron does a great job of evoking for us the central idea of home in the motivations of Confederate soldiers. In their understanding, that is what they are sacrificing their lives for. Now you might ask, what did this look like from the perspective of those for whom they were sacrificing their lives? What was it like for the women who lived in those homes that the Confederate soldiers were defending? No one has thought about this more thoroughly than Catherine Clinton, who has written about women in the war before and after for a long time. And she told me that when you look really closely at the lives of women in the Civil War era, Northern and Southern, white and black, a lot of the easy stereotypes and generalizations begin to fall away.
Men were coming home maimed. Men were coming home scarred. Men were coming home psychologically damaged. And then again, men weren't coming home. There were small towns in Wisconsin where marriageable age men were simply wiped out, an entire generation. And the young women became skilled at the rituals of mourning. And I think this really deeply affected their outlook on life. It scarred an entire generation of young women.
So it sounds like you would emphasize in some ways the commonalities perhaps that we've overlooked between Northern and Southern white women.
Right. And also the way in which war and men marching into war can create a commonality between women, black and white, in the South. When we look at matters of war unleashing violence against women, war unleashing men's restraints during wartime, I was struck by the fact that Jefferson Davis was someone who spoke about rape as a fate infinitely worse than death. So we look at the way in which gender and sexual politics during the war affected very dramatically how women lived the war, and that a woman alone, black or white, might be in fear of soldiers marching through. Maybe they were supposed to be liberators. Maybe they were our own boys. But in both cases, war can unleash terrors and cause a gender divide that was quite dramatic.
So the more we look at the Civil War, as Catherine Clinton shows us, the more you see that the humanity of the people at the time stretched over 4 years, dying in incomprehensible numbers, in incomprehensible ways, for causes that had been unimaginable.
Yeah.
It's going to require every skill the historian has
right.
to try to make sense of this.
And
thing.
I think, Ed, Catherine tells us something important, reminds us of something that is omnipresent in the experience of people in war. And that is, here we are fighting on behalf of civilization, however we define it. Yet just beneath the surface of civility and law is the reality of violence. And as Catherine quite rightly points out, and this is what Southern soldiers feared, as Aaron told us, when the forces of war are unleashed on your home, then the laws of war are hanging in suspense, And that is the whole notion of laws of war, which is the whole basis of modern international law, that you can somehow create conventions and standards of how you fight. Well, actually killing people blurs the distinction between barbarism and civilization, and it's that descent into barbarism that is the threat of all wars.
Yeah, and Peter, with that phrase, the threat of all wars, we really must confront this question of ultimately how different the civil war from all wars. Now, I who know the least about this, so I'll listen to your answers, but for me, it remains very distinctive primarily because we did this to ourselves. We fought this on our own homeland, so to speak, and that certainly makes it distinctive. But listening to you guys, especially about the number of young men who signed up without being coerced and their sense of patriotism, either to the Union or to their home state and the larger Confederacy, really underscores this notion of doing this to ourselves.
I think
and so
exactly
that,
right.
that remains distinctive to me, but I'd be curious to hear where you and Ed come down on this question.
Ed?
You know, I think it was an exceptional moment in American history, but I guess I'd argue that this is our version of something that all nations seem to go through at some time, right? They're fighting over who are we really?
Right.
And unlike other countries where they might be fighting over a religious difference or a long-standing who owns that piece of turf, here this was all about a future.
Yeah.
There was not anything immediately at stake because the North didn't think that it could abolish slavery in the Constitution. But Americans projecting themselves across space and across time were fighting in many ways over what the future of America would be.
Yeah, and I do think, I mean, you're exactly right that there have been so many civil wars. There's been so much slaughter in world history. We're not special in that regard. But what makes this special for us is that the United States was founded on the notion of a vision of peace, that is, that Republican government would end conflicts within nations, that this was a model for the world, that the Union was a way to transcend the problem of war that had scarred the European continent for centuries, that the Americans had the hubris, the pride to think that they had discovered the formula for progress and perpetual peace and prosperity, and that is Republican government. And that's why there's so much pathos in Lincoln's Civil War rhetoric about the meaning of the war, about the meaning of Republican government, because what the war was really demonstrating was the failure of that dream.
Well, guys, one thing is not exceptional, and that's that once again we've run out of time. But we want to know what our listeners think about all of this, and we want them to continue the conversation online. You can find us at backstoryradio.org. And while you're there, have a listen to the first installment of our Civil War series, The Road to War.
Again, that's backstoryradio.org. We're also on iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. Don't be a stranger.
Backstory is produced by Tony Field with help from Catherine Moore. Dylan Keith mastered the show, and Gabi Alter wrote our theme. Our interns are Jose Argueta and Miriam Kaplan. Special thanks today to Clinton Johnston. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Production support for Backstory is provided by Carrie Brown Epstein and the W.L. Lyons Brown Jr. Charitable Foundation, James Madison's Montpelier, Marcus and Carol Weinstein, Trish and David Crow, Austin Ligon, and an anonymous donor.
Brian Ballow and Peter Onuf are professors in the University of Virginia's Corcoran Department of History. Ed Ayers is president and professor of history at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham.